real life.
Superpowers.
Fear and excitement are identical twins. Identical. If we were to hook ourselves up to a machine that read our emotions, fear and excitement would read the same. The difference is the branding we give it. It's okay, what's going on? I've got butterflies in my stomach. I'm about to speak in front of 100 people and give my pitch. I'm like, oh my God, I'm so nervous. And those little butterflies, they're sneaky little devils. They'll turn black and grow fangs and fly up and like block your oxygen. And then, as opposed to, okay, I'm feeling butterflies in my stomach. Oh, I'm about to give a speech in front of 100 people. Oh my gosh, I'm so excited. And those butterflies, they love a good party. So they'll throw on their Burning Man clothes and pop a few shots of tequila and put on some Tiesto and dance. And that energy pulls you up with them. So the minute you stop fighting those butterflies and trying to get rid of them and just embrace them, that excitement shines through and brings exactly what you need it to.
Welcome to the Real Life Superpowers podcast. I'm Noa Eshed, co-hosting here with Vinen Manipaz. Today, we're excited to be joined by Donna Griffith, a world-renowned corporate storyteller, pitch alchemist, and best-selling author of Sticking to My Story, The Alchemy of Storytelling for Startups. Her ability to create, edit, and deliver powerful presentations, pitches, and messages has earned her a reputation as one of the most sought-after storytellers in the business world. For over two decades, Donna has been working extensively on a global scale, collaborating with Fortune 500 companies, startups, and investors across more than 30 countries. Her unique approach has led to outstanding results, with her clients collectively raising over $1.5 billion through her guidance. Let's dive into the mind of a true storytelling master.
Real life.
Superpowers. Superpowers.
Donna, welcome to Real Life Superpowers.
It's very exciting to be here.
Hey, Donna, how are you?
I'm great, and thanks for having me.
One of the world's top storytellers. That's quite a title.
Thank you. It's humbling to hear that, because I can think of so many role models of mine that led me here. But the biggest honor is to be able to do something that you love and that you're good at every single day. And that's, to me, like the epitome of happiness.
I agree. And I'm thinking, like, being a storyteller, that's not a regular job. How do you land there?
It's not like when I was growing up, I'm like, I want to be a storyteller. And, right. And it's funny, because the first few times I started calling myself a storyteller, when I heard it being used, really like 2008-ish, people were like, what do you mean? You a librarian? You go to these festivals and tell where people are telling stories around bonfires? And I'm like, no, I'm actually taking real life business people, real life techies, and turning them into, first of all, translating them. I say I'm the translator of Geek Speak, but bringing together to the world their greatness, their brilliance. Someone called me the polisher of diamonds. And I take that very seriously, because I work day in and day out with nothing short of diamonds. They're amazing. They're brilliant. My jaw drops on the floor several times a day. But their brilliance is oftentimes covered up in layers of bits and bytes and data and numbers and unnecessary facts. And it's like, okay, let's polish, let's peel, let's bring the brilliance out. And that's the essence of storytelling.
But it's interesting, though, because it's there are so many layers to what you do. There's that aspect of the actual storytelling, and there's so much to unpack there. And then there's your personal story of how you became the person creating those stories and you know, honing them.
So, I mean, maybe on a kid's career path today, there is storyteller and people are saying, I want to be a storyteller. And I grew up, which makes me really happy. And when my 10-year-old is working on a presentation for class where she had to talk about cyberbullying, and she started bringing all these facts. And I said to her, I'm sorry, as your mother, I can't let you not first talk about the need, the problem, a story about it. And she took that seriously. And she went, she researched, and she found sort of a kid's version of the Monica Lewinsky story and how Monica Lewinsky is now a big advocate for no cyberbullying and authentic behavior online, apparently. And she's telling this story, and I'm like, oh my gosh, what did they tell them about this? So they're storytelling at different levels, but she got it at the age of 10 that you can't just talk about your solution. You have to make people feel and have empathy and get like, yeah, this is really a problem that has to be solved. So for me, that kind of highlights my journey here. I didn't always know I wanted to be a storyteller. I always acted. I loved it. That was my number one love. But something in me also knew that it wasn't enough. The chances of making a steady income as an actor were, you know, slim to none. So I knew I needed to find something that I loved as much and I was passionate as much. And when I was about 16, I discovered this thing called drama therapy. And I'm like, oh my gosh, it's like somebody took my two great passions, working with people and acting, and put it together. And everything I did from that point on would get me into the NYU master's program. Seriously, when I was 16, that was like when so many of the things that paved that path. And then when I got there, I realized, oh, wow, the salaries are that of a starving artist. Now, what I said at the beginning about doing what you love and doing what you're good at, there's another piece to that in ikigai, which is a Japanese word for your reason for being. You need to be able to get paid for it, right? You can't deny that piece. And I didn't not become an actress to not be able to make a living that I felt I was proud of. And I could also not be reliant on anybody else. So I started kind of exploring, and I found at NYU, there was a program for training and organizational development. Like I had somebody mentioned that they had a friend that had traveled the globe giving workshops. And that to me sounded like, oh my gosh, sign me up. How do I do that? And I found this program. I enrolled and I sent my resume out to the first place I saw looking for corporate trainers. And I landed in an amazing company called Boyer Communications Group in New York. And I traveled the globe for them for like a decade, giving workshops, working with C-suite, helping people tell powerful stories in companies like Intel and Progressive Insurance and all kinds of everything from high tech. I said, it's chips to chips to chips, silicon chips, chocolate chips, potato chips, the whole shebang. And then came 2008. I don't know if y'all were around for that, but it was a very scary time financially because everything was like everyone was taking all the precautions. And the first thing to go in an organization is the not essentials. And in that case, it was workshops that, you know, train you how to tell stories or how to give powerful presentations. I mean, that is the lifeblood of the company to be able to sell, but I can understand it. And suddenly my schedule was wiped clean for months to come. And that's a scary place to be. I wasn't yet married. I didn't have kids, but it's still, you know, I'm used to being an independent woman. What now? And that one now kind of started to evolve into startups. I was asked by someone to work with a client of theirs who was a cardiothoracic surgeon. And he needed help on his professional speeches in front of his guild. He was the head of the cardiothoracic surgeons and the cardiologists, who apparently don't like each other very much. And he showed me two medical devices he had created while we were working on his professional speech. And he said, you know, I was invited to an angel conference in New York to speak in front of 80-something angels. I have 5 minutes for each product. Can you help me with those? And I said, well, I've never worked with a startup before, but hey, a story is a story. And we really worked this, and I ended up going with him and presenting on his behalf, which I've never done since, but he was of a seniority that it was kind of acceptable. And the other companies that had been invited got up to pitch, and my heart just broke for them. Because before they even could open their mouths, it was like they were being just shot down by everyone. And I'm like, why wouldn't they take somebody like me to help them prepare? Then I was like, wait a minute, somebody like me. I started exploring. Nobody was really doing storytelling for startups at the time. Storytelling was so nascent. There was marketing, like what you do. And that was starting to get more awareness. But, and I was like, okay, this is my new audience. And then come the voices. Startups, they're not going to pay you. They don't have money. They don't really need you. They can do it themselves, but the founder can't tell their own story. Blah, 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 blah. And I said, you know, thank you very much. And I proceeded. And I started to, my first business model was, I called it sponsorship as a service. I approached all the accelerators that I could find, all the tech competitions that I could find. And I said, let me work with your companies that are pitching. Let me get their pitches great. All I ask in return is put my logo up among the sponsors and acknowledge me at the event. Like say my name so people kind of look and I can wave. And at first they're like, we only take money for sponsorship. We don't take services. And I said, okay, until I was called in as a pinch hitter like 3 days before a competition that the pitches were just horrendous. And we turned them around and it was like, you could see on the faces of the audience, they were like saying, wow, these pictures are really good. What's going on here? Who's this Donna person? Because then they thanked me. And little by little, it started to come through. And I mean, you talk about superpowers. Just because someone is a brilliant founder doesn't mean their superpowers lie in being a great storyteller. I couldn't sit there coding or coming up with incredible innovations that change the world, but I know how to tell the story for that. So we all focus on if we can find that area of genius, that area of greatness, and do something with it, that's our true calling. That's our ikigai.
In a sense, then, yeah, like the acting, okay?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I have a feeling that the acting, you talked about empathy in the beginning of the conversation. So using empathy and acting, does it help you for the theatrical sense of storytelling? Because I have a feeling that, you know, you're saying about them not having great pitches, but as an actor, you have to get involved and tell someone else's story and be in their shoes, right? Like, how did that attribute and like how did you know that to combine that? Did you feel like it was something that gave you that infrastructure to make great pitches because of it?
Absolutely. And well, first of all, I have to train others. I do a lot of workshops and training. And if you're standing up in front of a group of a few dozen people or a few hundred people, you have to be interesting. So that's where the stage training really comes in. And I have that naturally, but I also honed it. And so first of all, being a performer and making people laugh and holding their attention, that definitely helps. Now, empathy, I don't know if that is exactly about acting and like getting into someone's role, because I mean, I think that a lot of actors are extremely self-centered and completely absorbed in where they're at. They don't necessarily think about the other side. So that is one of the most important skills that I teach in the workshops and that I've had to learn for myself. It's like putting yourself in the other person's shoes, 180 degrees, thinking, what do they know? What don't they know? What would they want to know? Why would this be interesting to them? And writing your speech, your pitch, your presentation from their perspective, not your own, not what you want to sell, not your goals. It's totally and completely about them.
It's like screenwriting, maybe more than acting.
Yes. So the acting, think of it as like the acting is the delivery part. You want to have passion. You want to have an interesting voice, but the script, the actual writing, the storytelling, you want it to be fascinating from the eye of your watcher or your reader. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Screenwriting is a very good example for that.
Donna, I'm fascinated with the early stages here. You at 16 were already dismissing a passion and you were trying to figure out exactly what your career path is going to be. And that's fairly unique. I don't know many high school students who are busy with that and not, you know, with their popularity ranking and, you know, other stuff that people deal with at that stage. Even like, you know, college students are pretty much like the first years are about, you know, beer and friends and stuff. And you seem very focused from a very young age and also very grounded, like to say, I love acting, but I'm not going to be an actor when, you know, that's the years that you dream. And you know, and you don't say, you didn't even give it a chance.
It's funny. I've not really thought about that, but I think growing up, you know, my mom was divorced a few times. I was from the first marriage. And I think growing up in those circumstances kind of matures you fast and makes you think about the future. And I was lucky that I looked at my parents' mistakes and I was able to kind of process them and acknowledge them and learn from them and say, okay, I want to do it differently. Here's those spaces. I have no idea how I came. I mean, now that I have a 10-year-old and she's extremely focused and extremely grounded and like, she's so wise beyond her years. I'm like, maybe there's something genetic here. I don't quite know how to put my finger on what at that age led me to do that. But seeing that she's already having these deep thoughts about the future and what she wants to do. And she told me yesterday, she's like, I know I talk a lot, so I really try to listen. And I'm like, holy bleep, she's 10. That's incredible insight about yourself to know that. Cause I always talked a lot. I was told from, you know, from teachers, Donna talks a lot. She needs to learn to zip the lip. And my mom would send me little notes saying, you know, MYOB and ZTL. And I've made a career out of it. And I'm like, gosh, am I glad that I didn't listen to those teachers? And I said to my daughter, I said, listen, it's fine to talk and share, but it's wonderful that you're acknowledging that listening is a huge part of communication. At the age of 10, I'm just blown away.
And what if she wants to be an actor?
I will be all for letting her explore that and opening up her up to other. She loves to perform. I enrolled both girls into a theater camp for the summer. I want them to explore. I want them to hone it. And I want them to make their own discoveries. I don't want to say, no, don't be an actor.
But you didn't try to discover it. You realized you love it and that it's not going to happen.
I acted. I did plays and I did commercials and I did voiceovers from the time I remember myself. But I mean, as I lived in New York and I was getting my master's at NYU, I was also in an acting school. And it totally was there as the passion. It just wasn't my main pursuit of a livelihood.
There's a saying that the convergence of skills is where people can truly shine. So, and by the way, it said specifically about public speaking, like if you take public speaking and another skill, then, and you converge those, then you can be truly great at whatever that other skill is. And I think what you're doing in a sense is amplifying that, because you're taking your public speaking skills and the delivery skills and you're wrapping everything up together. And that's actually what you're delivering for others. That's pretty unique.
Well, I think that's something that my boss, Brad Boyer, who was the first to hire me, saw that. When he interviewed me, and he's like, you know, everything looks great. This looks like a great match on your resume, but I need to see you on stage. And I just had a show opening the next week that I was in. It was a 1940 show about sisters in Ireland, and I was doing an Irish accent. It was called Nora's Bloke. And I was playing Deirdre, and he came to the show the first night. I didn't even know he was in the audience, thank goodness. And he called me the next day. He's like, the minute you walked on stage, it lit up, and that's all I had to see. So I think that there is this kind of, sometimes somebody sees something in you and calls it out to you, and you're like, I didn't even realize it was there. And having that kind of moment and paying attention to it is extremely important too.
And by the way, what you just described is what you do with startups.
I help them accentuate the bright points. Absolutely. Absolutely. That's what I try to do. And even there, I don't know how the process works. Like my nickname now for the last year is Donna GPT. Because I have this innate capacity to like process all this data and sift through it and then clean it and put out a powerful story in real time. People go like, how did you just do that? I don't know. I don't know how I just did it. I honestly think I have some kind of LLM and algorithms in my brain that sift through it. And I don't come from their background. I'm not a computer scientist. I'm not in finance. I'm not in cyber. I'm not a physician. I'm not a scientist. But I am a distiller of a lot of techno babble and techno speak into powerful stories.
It was not your only bright light. Like because as a performer, you should have stood out. Like, is it like that? Was that the first time that someone got super excited about like you seeing you doing that? Or
no, I think though it was the first time that somebody was able to identify that this is a career path that I can take. So, and then it was corporate storytelling and training for presentation skills and business writing skills. So that kind of validated for me that I was on the right path, but there was like an A to B to C to D that were kind of
right.
scattered moments of like leading you into the right path, like discovering drama therapy. When I was 16, my great uncle took me to meet a career counselor friend of his at a college, just because I was trying to kind of be interested in what I was doing. And he told me about this. So it's like moments in life that you encounter these, I call them angel singing moments. Oh, and you're like, if you hear them and you lift your head up from your phone a second and, or you see the flashing lights, it's like, this is a moment you don't want to miss. And what are you going to do about it is the question. Do you go forward? And I always find at those very important junctures, I'm also scared out of my mind. And that I know that now to recognize that I'm in the right way with that then. So if you're really feeling that utter fear of your stomach falling out of your body, you know that that's the step you have to take. It's kind of paradoxical, but it's true.
It's like the excitement. The excitement is also, can also be interpreted as fear, right? So,
and that's what I teach with public speaking. That's one of the things that I say. Fear and excitement are identical twins. Identical. If we were to hook ourselves up to a machine that read our emotions, fear and excitement would read the same. The difference is the branding we give it. It's okay, what's going on? I've got butterflies in my stomach. I'm about to speak in front of 100 people and give my pitch. I'm like, oh my God, I'm so nervous. And those little butterflies, they're sneaky little devils. They'll turn black and grow fangs and fly up and like block your oxygen. And then as opposed to, okay, I'm feeling butterflies in my stomach. Oh, I'm about to give a speech in front of 100 people. Oh my gosh, I'm so excited. And those butterflies, they love a good party. So they'll throw on their Burning Man clothes and pop a few shots of tequila and put on some Tiesto and dance. And that energy pulls you up with them. So the minute you stop fighting those butterflies and trying to get rid of them and just embrace them, that excitement shines through and brings exactly what you need it to. So fear becomes if fear becomes face everything and recover.
And there's like a theme here of taking a mess and sort of making it clear and taking control of it. And it's both with what you do on stage, and it's also with the storytelling aspect of how people present things and how they translate what their tech talk is to stuff that people can understand. And the fact that you're actually not coming from those industries is probably an advantage, because you're able to now turn that into human talk.
I think it's definitely an advantage. And I always feel like I'm coming with a clean slate and a clean filter. They've been looking at this stuff for months, years, and it's very hard when it's right here to see it clearly, when it's right in front of your face. And it's, for me, it's like I'm pulling back. I'm looking at it from a completely objective point, but I also have the experience of having looked at hundreds of others in their industry and in adjacent industries, which gives kind of this like, I kind of feel sometimes like it's putting together a puzzle. Ooh, this piece over here will fit nicely here. Oh, and that. And then like sometimes it's funny, but it's bringing in pieces from other puzzles and they fit. I don't quite know how that works, but it does. It's connecting the dots. It's sometimes like, oh, that reminded me of this. Oh, and what about that? Oh, and what about if we brought in something about that? And oh, I heard this investor story that read that article. Like I'm always trying to bring in new information that will make me better at telling the story for my clients.
Also daring to be creative where people are sort of scared. And, you know, I think also not many people are brutally honest in a way that's healthy. So a founder or any company for that matter can be writing content or delivering text or story that isn't very understandable, but it sounds smart, and people are impressed with sound smart. So they can walk away not understanding a thing, but thinking they're the problem.
Actually that's not impressive at all. That's like we go to school and we learn all these big words and we think that's how we need to speak in order to impress. And it's totally counterintuitive to our basic storytelling communication that as kids we learn, and you have young children, so you know how they start to develop language, and it's based on stories you read them and stories they see and interactions. And that's how we learn the world. And then our brains get convoluted with all this crazy, big, impressive speak that nobody gets anyway. They'll forget you the second they're out of the room, rather than speaking at a level that speaks, I call it the mind, heart, gut message. You want everything touched.
There's this saying that I heard, it's an old one. If you can't impress them with your brilliance, dazzle them with your bullshit.
I love it.
And how many companies and startups, but not only, are busy dazzling with bullshit when they fail to realize that the people dazzled, and I'll say quote unquote dazzled, are not going to progress to being business. They may be impressed with the person and think, okay, this person is smarter than me, but they're not going to work with that person.
Well, I think though that makes me think right away of Samuel Banks Friedman and of Adam Neumann and Elizabeth Holmes, who I don't put exactly in the same category. I don't think Adam Neumann had the kind of malicious intent knowingly that he was like cheating investors. I think he was a great talker. I think he did reinvent a category. I mean, WeWork was a thing and it actually worked. I don't think he was really siphoning money off that, whether it was kosher or not, the way he did things, that's sort of gray. Whereas Elizabeth Holmes, she set out to do something that would be truly transformational and life-saving. And along the way, she realized she was putting people's lives at risk, and she did it anyway.
Right.
SBF had created that he was taking money, the homes and islands and all this hubris and these parties and everything, knowing full well that this was outside the lines of what would be right. And a lot of people lost a lot of money, and industry was completely demolished. Nobody wants to hear about Web3 or crypto or blockchain. And I think that this is a field that has a lot of merit and will have its day again. But after what happened there, and that's the thing, so many investors were dazzled and they were looking at others that were dazzled, seeing them dazzled. They're like, well, I better get on the dazzle train. And people look for these signals. So, it's exactly FOMO. And again, it's like you're looking at my workshop there. I have a slide with the guy in a suit running after a train. And that's exactly that. Nobody wants to feel like they missed the FOMO train. Nobody wants to feel like, you know, there's this great blog post by Brian Chesky of Airbnb that he republished when they IPO'd, but it had initially come out, and it's called 7 Rejection Emails. And that's exactly what it is. It's like 7 emails with the names redacted of when they were raising, get this, $150K at a $500K valuation. And their valuation when they IPO'd, I think, was $8 billion. I mean, crazy. People could have owned a 10% stake in Airbnb. And it was things like, you know, thanks for meeting with us. We don't really see it. We don't see travel as this. We don't really, you know, you're focused on something too niche. And all he wrote at the bottom was something to the tune of, when you're having a bad day and you've gotten a lot of no's, read these emails. And it's like, if he could have given them that FOMO, that glimpse into the future of what would be, I mean, that's crazy. So I want people to create that FOMO by looking for trends and looking for things happening that point to the fact that you are the next big thing. That's my silver bullet that I talk about in slides, and I talk about in the book too. But it's like, make them, you know, dig into that FOMO, make them move from that place, because that's a real motivator. It's not the only motivator.
Yeah.
And nor should it be, but it's definitely one.
So how can people know when they're on the wrong track with respect to how they're presenting themselves or what they do?
Usually they end up contacting me. They're like, people aren't getting it. We know we have a great product, and people just aren't either responding to the messages we send out, or they're not, they're like, you know, great meeting, keep us posted or whatever. And they're like, something is getting lost between the brilliance of our product and their understanding. Now, the easiest thing to do is to blame them, saying, well, they just don't get us. And that's bullshit. Exactly what you said before. It is, because you have to take responsibility for everybody getting what you do very clearly. So that's where you want to come and kind of move the crap out of the way. It's like, I used to be much more of a gatherer of things before I met my husband. And now I'm much more satisfied when there's like a cleanness and there's not a lot of clutter around, because it helps me see clearly. So sometimes we just have to move the clutter. I'll be the Marie Kondo of fidget, the clutter aside, to be able to see the essence and the beauty and the simplicity of the story. Sometimes it's just going back to the origin story and connecting those dots. I worked with a company yesterday, and it was just really very powerful, because one of the ideas, and they're doing like AI for sourcing electronic components for hardware and electronic product companies. And the idea was sparked to him because a baby had died in a hospital, preemie baby, and the incubator was faulty, it turned out. And it's like, wow, you know, life and death. And then someone's life being saved because of a pacemaker, life and death in the hand of electronic devices. And it's all about sometimes one of the million components that go into a smartwatch or go into a computer or go into something even bigger. And today, engineers are sifting through thousands and thousands of different SKUs and different things, and will it be available? And they're wasting months. So that's the story we created before. It was just like, you know, blah, 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 the time and the numbers, but it's adding that layer. And what do you think people are going to remember?
Of course, the story.
They're going to remember the stories.
But what are like the common mistakes that founders seem to make?
Being too factual, being too straight, like this is what we do. Like every single time I meet a new company, it's like they're gung-ho to talk about themselves and their product first. And that goes whoosh right over my head. What I'm retraining them to do and working with them to do is first start with the story of, you know, how you started, why it matters, because that's what's going to resonate or make people go, oh yeah, I've been there before. And that's what storytelling does. It connects us. It resonates. It forges a connection. It makes me think, oh, we have something in common here. Or, oh my gosh, I wouldn't want that happening to me. But it makes us think. And then we're much more open to, okay, so how are you going to solve this? I didn't realize this was such a big problem. And we want to, of course, add in numbers and dollars to back that up, that this is a true problem that nobody's touched on. Like, that's what I love about working with startups. Always new little holes in the system that are bleeding billions that they've discovered with a way to make it work better, more efficiently.
In a sense, what you're saying is, like, most people present the problem from a perspective of this is what's needed, and they're missing the involvement or attachment of an audience understanding that being part of the story from the beginning to even want to be in a perspective of wanting to help solve that problem.
So it's even more than that. First of all, sometimes they don't even touch on the problem. Okay. What you're describing is the next level. Okay, first of all, it's talking about the problem. Second of all, it's attaching their personal involvement to it, which A, shows their passion, shows their commitment, shows their thought process, shows the fact that they abandoned everything else because they saw this as a big enough problem, but also connects the other side into it. And that is, like, I always say, you want to tell a story so that the investor, when they're having a barbecue with their other investor friends on Sunday and trading war stories and like, oh my gosh, I saw this amazing company, and they can relate the story without their notes in front of them. And that cool factor of like, dude, I went in on that deal.
You're actually empowering likability. You're actually like, what you're adding is the likability. It's like the,
thank you. Have you read my book? I don't know, but so there's three things investors are continuously listening for: credibility, likability, and momentum. You need to know what you're doing. You need to come from the background with the credentials.
Which usually the credentials is the easy part for all the founders,
right? That's the easy part. People don't always like to put that front and center. I'm like, gosh, you've got a serial entrepreneur with two exits. Why aren't you like putting that in neon letters? The momentum piece is important because it's showing how far have you gotten to prove that there's money here. People want it. People buy it. People are put their name behind it. And then the likability piece is not just like, oh my gosh, I'm so cute and fun and likable. It's more about a true connection of like, wow, this is a good person. This is someone who I want to work with. This is someone who I want to put my money, my time, my resources into because they're open to learning and to listening.
I'm thinking like, there was this wave where startups needed to sell a dream, and that worked really well with investors. And when you throw in FOMO, all the more. And I think these days, there's less of that. I'm getting this sort of sense that some investors are sort of feeling like, okay, we've been led toward dreams and we now have to sort of screen noise. So I'm wondering if the storytelling aspect is a little toned down these days looking toward investment, because it's more about the numbers and less about the emotion, because maybe investors are feeling like this could end up being a manipulation of sorts. But I will say at the same time that I think when you talk to the end users, the customers or whoever that startup is selling to, I'm sure the storytelling aspect is still as important. But is it as important for investors these days?
Okay. So let me break that down in a few ways. So first of all, I think what happened in 2021 when they were basically handing out $10 million like hotcakes at crazy, insane, ballooned up valuations was the market was setting these companies up to fail.
Yeah.
And the companies were setting themselves up to fail by accepting these terms. Because now, I call this the class of 2021's reckoning day, they are coming to their next rounds. And they don't have the metrics to support the numbers to support that kind of valuation. So it's going to be a down round. They'll be valued. And I think that's been expected and people know that that's coming. So they have a much harder time showing the results that prove that they were worthy of that. Absolutely has to be there, but you can't not put the story and the emotion in it as well. You just have to back it up much more and maybe change the order of things. So for more advanced companies, I put the first slide I put in, I call it the brag slide. I mean, don't ever actually call it the brag slide. That's my little nickname for it. But it's like the numbers that speak to what you've done in terms of growth, in terms of engagement, in terms of revenues, in terms of pipeline, in terms of IP, anything that you can truly show, that's what you want to start with. Because that's going to be like, okay, now you got my attention. And then companies that work with me will be like, yeah, but they don't know what I do yet. And I'm like, first of all, they've read up on you. If they're in a meeting with you, they know kind of what you do. Second of all, it doesn't matter what you do, because if you've got these kind of numbers, they're like, okay, let me put on my listening ears. You got me, bitch. So it's kind of a game of knowing how and when and what to do, but you can't make it devoid of a story ever. It just doesn't work. I've seen it again and again and again. And every time I'm just so frustrated when there's a good story there. And I know that they, for whatever reason, fear or being proper or whatever, like left it out. I have to be exactly according to the game. You don't.
What do you do with the opportunistic ones where you're listening and you're hearing, okay, these people are here for the money. There's no passion behind it. They think they identified an opportunity and that's the business.
I don't take on clients that aren't ready to actually pitch. I mean, I've stopped sessions and said, listen, you are not ready for me.
What is a client that's not ready? What does that mean?
So some think they have this incredible idea and it's unlike anything else, but there's a lot like it. Some have this real dream, like you said, and haven't even put together an MVP and think they're going to raise just on the idea, and they're not. They're just not. I mean, I'm not a dream squasher, but you have to be realistic. So I kind of look at it as like, okay, I want to make this great meal and I go to my fridge and I have a quarter of a jar of mustard, some leftover Chinese food and half a lemon. I'm not going to make a feast out of that. There's just no way. I need ingredients to be able to cook a meal. So if I don't have the ingredients from them, I can't cook their pitch. They have to bring me the ingredients. You can, you know, sort of go with the flow and you're missing one here or there, you fill it in and it still can taste great. But if you're missing, like, I don't have a product, you haven't done the research, you don't know anything about your competition, you're playing in a field that is, you're just going to be torn down. I just don't think you're there.
Is there no such thing as a boring business that's actually making money, but you dig and there's no life in there?
No such thing. You can always find, because numbers can be very sexy and appealing if you tell them in the right way. I don't think that there is any boring business. I think it's just the way it's presented sometimes is boring.
I agree. And I think in the United States, there's also a more ready culture in the sense that there's something in the culture that's storytelling oriented when I compare it to Israel. And I also studied law. So I was thinking that also when I was reading cases like court cases in Israel versus American ones. And you hear a story and you want to keep reading when you're reading the American ones. And in Israel, there's always like this jargon and there's always it's difficult to understand. And you feel like they're sort of trying to create this moat between the reader, the average reader, and a person who has some law background. So in a sense, I think that working with American companies, they're more open to the storytelling part because it's more in their nature. And I think Israeli startups, when they have to work with the global market, they suddenly have to adjust them and open themselves up to that type of mindset. But I think that's also where the greatest leaps can happen.
Mm-hmm. I mean, yes and no to a lot of that. I think I remember my early years of elementary school when I was still in the U.S., we did book reports and we'd have to get up in front of the class and present, or we'd have to become a character and present. Like there was this kind of built in innate public speaking without calling it public speaking. And, you know, we like take books and turn them into plays. I mean, that's what I know. So, and I see my daughters have a lot of that here too. So I think when you grow up with that being a part of it, it does come more easy, but you can't bullshit Silicon Valley investors. I'm sorry, we're coming back to the third bleep here. So you need to also be able to tell that motivating the pain, or as they're calling it nowadays, this is their favorite catchphrase, hair on fire moment, in a very succinct, powerful, quick story. You don't want to move, too long and drag it on. They're like, okay, don't snowball me. Just cut to the chase. They're extremely smart. They've seen this before. I want to find something that would surprise them. If I can find that one thing that's going to make them go, then I know we've got something good. And that's challenging because like these are some of the most brilliant and experienced people I've ever met. And they've been founders, or they've been investors, or they've been investment bankers, or they come from this and they know. And you can't really just, pull the wool or storytell your way out of it. You got to have the substance too.
So how do you do that?
Again, I don't know how to explain how it happens in the moment with the process. But what I did try to do in the book, Sticking to My Story, came out exactly a year ago next week. So Sticking to My Story, The Alchemy of Storytelling for Startups, is break it down into a followable method. If we go back to the foodie metaphor, it's like the cookbook. So you can either come to my restaurant and sit at the chef's table and I will cook for you, or you can take it home and do the recipes yourself. I wanted this to be a methodology that is repeatable and doable. So there's the chunks and the acts. I call it like a four-act play of your investor deck. It's repeatable. It's questions that everyone can do. And I take them step by step through it. That's how you do it. That's how you build storytelling. And there's a specific flow to it. But it's all about listening to your audience before you even meet with them and answering their questions before they even ask them.
We're excited to be collaborating with the Israeli website CTech, owned by Kalkalist, Israel's leading business newspaper. CTech is the gateway of the Israeli high tech to the tech world and vice versa. If you're not already a regular reader, we strongly recommend that you check out kalkalistech.com, kalkalistech.com, to stay up to date on all high impact stories from the Israeli tech scene.
What was the biggest difference writing a book between like like doing like the presentations for the companies? Like, how did you approach the book differently? Was it a challenge for you to tell that story, or was it like easy?
The challenge was getting myself to actually sit down and do it. It reminded me like when I wrote my thesis, many years ago, I joked that it took me 6 months to write. 3 months of it was bitching and moaning about the fact that I had to write it, and 3 months was actually sitting my butt down and doing it. And thank God there wasn't social media back then, because it would have been a big distraction. I think with the book, had I found my USB port and been able to put a thumb drive in and download it, that would have cut out a lot of the work. It was all there. It was just about putting in the right framework, putting in the right thing, having somebody objective, my editor, reading it and giving me feedback and saying this would work.
So how'd you sit down though? How'd you sit down? Like, how'd you do that at the end?
Starting with a commitment and working with the editor, and first having I said, this is only going to work if I have a weekly meeting on schedule with you. So I'm committed to either writing or using that time. If I haven't had time to write, say, I'm not going to meet with you today, I'm going to use that time to write. And it started as an hour. Now, I had also written a lot of blogs and kind of about each component of the deck over the years. And I was always like, okay, that'll be a chapter in my book. That'll be a chapter. So I was able to take a lot of things I wrote, weave them together, repurpose them, add stories. So I think the most important part was writing where I had energy around it first, not necessarily going linearly. I think one of the first chapters, which is the background of storytelling, I left to the very end because that I needed to research that and find the right quotes and find the right things that I had. I'm like, that feels too much like a thesis to me. I'll do that at the end, which I did. So, and then I'd mark off each chapter. So I wrote the outline and I'd mark off each chapter as it was written and as it was in there. And the more I did it, the more I enjoyed it. And the longer I'd spend doing it, the more time I'd like just block out to do it.
And I got to ask, like, there's this formula, but then if there's a number of startups in the same industry, and mm-hmm. putting aside the fact that the investors are already, you know, they know the industry, how are you able to shine with unique numbers and surprise where at the end of the day, there are limited data sources that you can turn to?
So it's especially like something like cyber, where every single cyber company yeah. almost sounds like they're doing the same thing.
Right.
So that's the unique challenge for me for each cyber company I work with, to find a different direction, a different pitch, a different thing. And we just do it. And it might be some of the same numbers, but what I say is it's not just the numbers that everyone knows and how many attacks there are and how it's growing and how much it's costing the industry. Those are known things, but looking for the smaller moments that they might not know that you have found within your little niche of your world and your unique insight, that to me is what's fascinating. And I want to dig out and bring out for them to see, because that's going to be what's this is something else. I haven't heard this yet, or I've heard this before, but never quite like this.
But at the end of the day, you know, they, most of them have competitors. Mm. So mm-hmm. like you are digging for specifics. Even if you don't know exactly what you're looking for, you are able to identify things that will make them stand out.
And it's, again, it's like looking at, like, I thought the other day about, I remembered the movie A Beautiful Mind, and like, not to right. say that I'm, but like he'd look at things and things would just like leap off the page. And that sometimes I feel that like viscerally in my stomach, I look at something, I'm like, okay, that's where, or I'll be listening and I'll be like, okay, that's where we need to start. And then once you find one thread, everything just kind of follows and flows. And then sometimes you hit a knot, you hit a snag. So you have to kind of backtrack and find something else. It just emerges. And again, it's part talent, part skill, part mileage.
It totally makes sense to me in the sense of communicating to end users, because there's more wiggle room there, I would say. But when there's a competitive niche and you're pitching to tier one investors, and I think that's actually where you probably shine, but it's also so challenging to be able to make something I was about to say to make something sound unique, but I think you're probably helping them. You know, there's that saying, know thyself. I think you're able to actually tell them what's unique about them through the process you're doing with them.
And many times they'll say to me, you know, this is how we used to tell it. And it feels like coming home to them, because it was like they started off this way. And over time, people said, well, don't say that or say that. And then it turns into what I call a patchwork pitch. You've kind of piecemealed things together rather than, okay, this is our truth. This is why we're doing this. This is where we started. And you want to elevate that. You constantly need to be elevating it, but you want something that is truly you. I want to find the words that truly could have been written by them. I don't want it to sound like them speaking Donna words. I always ask, you know, do you feel comfortable with this word or should we find another word? And that's what a good speechwriter does. You don't think of like, oh, wow, Clinton must have had an amazing speechwriter, or Gandhi must have had an amazing, or even Martin Luther King. They just had for a Super Bowl, a commercial with his speechwriter.
Yeah.
Of the I Have a Dream speech.
Yeah.
I don't think until this moment anyone ever thought, wow, that speechwriter was a genius. We all thought Martin Luther King, wow. And that's the thing about storytelling. It doesn't mean just because you didn't write it, that it's not yours. It's not your words. It's an amalgam. It's an alchemy of taking that person's words and thoughts and discoveries and then finding the way to fit it together in the way that goes boom and is memorable and repeatable for years to come.
Beautiful. And do you have many competitors since you've started? Because I'm hearing storytelling in business a lot over the past few years.
Yeah. And once upon a time, it wasn't there. And now everybody calls himself a storyteller. And, you know, it's great to have competition. And I'm glad that there's different people at different levels that can do different things. There's one of me and everybody needs storytelling help. I do think I've achieved a certain level of it. One person in our intro call, he's like, I said to my investor, I want the Beyonce of storytelling. And the investor's like, call Donna. And I'm like, okay, that's it. I can retire now. I'm done. Doesn't get better than that to be called like the Beyonce of storytelling. But
Donna, that's logical. Like the amount of clients that you have, like just the Beatles, they went to perform, you know, the 10,000 hour thing. So like, it looks like to me that you have like, what did you already like 1,000 pitches already for companies? How much like a number?
So, I mean, it's been at least 1,000, if not more. And it's over $1.5 billion raised by the people that I worked with. And then there's like tons of
It should
of
be more. I see that like there's a Yola and there's a J Frog and you know and
J Frog when they were mere tadpoles.
and like Wix and stuff like that. Like I don't know if you're
Wix, I didn't work with them on their investor decks. I've given trainings for their employees.
Oh, so it's pitches for investors.
Some of it are and some of it are. Yeah, I also work on other like sales and working once a company grows and they're not necessarily raising funding, there's other communications that
I see.
So yeah, and JFrog, we did work on their investment. They were trying to raise for 5 years their Series A. Nobody knew what the hell they were doing. And they had this teeny tiny office on top of a falafel shop and you could barely find parking. And I actually met them at a competition, a pitch competition that I was coaching for Tel Aviv University. And the companies had 2 minutes to pitch, which back in the day was like, how 2 minutes? And even though I worked with them and coached them, nobody could tell what they were doing. And Shlomi came to me at the end of the at the competition. He's like, I think we need to hire you. And I worked with them for a while. And I ran into him. He lives here. And he gave this great speech recently. And he's like, so am I a better storyteller now? I said, you're an amazing storyteller. Then and it's wonderful to hear all these stories coming around. But it's like, you know, they've built this empire. And at the beginning, nobody knew what they were doing. It was kind of ahead of the time. So you need to find the story that people get.
And I just had to ask another question about the client for a second. You have Prezi as a client, right? Which is like the whole idea of Prezi is to storytell. So what do you storytell about a storyteller?
So Prezi, again, they actually commissioned me to do workshops that were open to their community of users. I got this great tool, Prezi, now learn how to use it. So it was a series of three workshops that was open to all their users and all their paying subscribed users to be able to give them the storytelling. And of course, they redesigned my slides using Prezi. They took my my slides.
So they used you. They used you, and like in a sense, not used you, but they used you as a person to give ideas of how to tell, to how to utilize that
exactly.
system.
So, yeah, I think of Prezi or PowerPoint or Canva or any of these as like the Pyrex or the pans that you will cook your delicious dishes in.
Right.
Everybody can use them and it's going to taste completely different because you're putting the flavor of what, well, can you tell I like food? The flavors that are unique to you in it, but that's just the container. That's the shape. That's the, you know, it's, you can't blame it, but it can definitely ruin a dish if you don't, you know, if the dish breaks or it's not, you know, distributing heat in the right way. But you can't say, oh, my pitch was horrible because PowerPoint sucks.
Well, you can say it. It just won't, you know, it won't be a really good excuse.
Yeah. No, no, no.
And Donna, what would you say, like, what do you say your superpower would be?
Seeing through bullshit and getting to the core of what people are saying and then finding a way for them to say it in the way that's the most powerful. I see stories. It's got, you know, in, what was the movie? I see dead people. I see stories.
Sixth Sense. But what, Sixth so would you
Thank
say,
you.
It, it has a little bit to do with also like optimism and perception, perceptive optimism maybe?
Optimism is my fuel. My motto, my credo in life is, of course, I'm an optimist. I don't see much point in being anything else. Winston Churchill. And I, for the past 4 months, have been putting my storytelling skills to use for storytelling Israel and storytelling the Jews. Mm-hmm. And it's a very emotional time for all of us. And I keep trying to think, okay, if I were a typical American Gen Xer, I'm not talking about the Gen Zs right now because that's a completely different set of communication skills that I just can't right now connect to. I think there's a lot of stuff going on there, but like a typical, if I was like the mirror image of myself, American 40 something with a few kids living in the suburbs, not Jewish, not Israeli, not connected, what would touch my heart to make me realize, oh my gosh, there's something horrible happened here and something awful is happening. So it's really about, I've been choosing a much more optimistic narrative. I can't take it when people are like, oh, the hostages aren't going to come back. I'm like, just don't talk to me because I can't. It's like putting the wrong kind of fuel in your engine. It's like going to the gas station instead of getting benzene, putting solar in and like your car is going to break down. Why do that to yourself? Shimon Peres was interviewed at the Jubilee of Israel 15 years ago, was it? And he said, and they said, you know, why are you such an optimist? How are you so optimistic? And he said, pessimists and optimists die the same way. Isn't it better to live?
Nice.
Even our national anthem, the hope, Hatikva, it's not about like, we'll get by somehow. It's like we have hope and it's what's sustained us. And looking at that, I'm like, I'm not naive. And there's a lot of bad stuff going on in the world, but it's like choosing to fuel yourself with optimism, I think, is a much more powerful force than freezing in the face of pessimism.
And I would also say that it does have an impact, even if we're not exactly sure how. Like it does, I do think saying, believing that things will be okay actually helps towards that.
I agree. I felt the same way during COVID when things were shut down and we didn't know what was going to happen and the kids were home and all of that. I kept saying we're going to find a way out of this. If I had known when it started that my daughter would be home pretty much all for 2 years on and off, I would have gone bananas. And the impact it had on her was awful. But it's like being in the moment and knowing that things will work out because they have to. the truth has to come to light, when good has to prevail over evil. Like, maybe that's a little Hollywood sappy storytelling of me, but I truly believe that. And me that's too. What I choose to believe.
Me too.
And on that sense of optimism, what would you say are weaknesses?
Oh, my weakness? Wow. I think I've made peace with a lot of my weaknesses and worked on them so much over the years that I just kind of embrace them as like, you know what, I'd rather be someone's shot of whiskey than everybody's cup of tea. So I don't even see them as weaknesses anymore as much as I'm like, that's me. Those are the flaws. I'm not going to Botox it over. It's just, you know, and I don't know. Maybe sometimes I'm not a procrastinator, but when it comes to like changing a model or taking the next leap or doing it, it can take a while for me to get there. And at first, like my husband always laughs at me because like, he'll come up with some crazy idea. He's of course a founder. And then he'll be like, you need to do this. And I'm like, no, I can't. And then of course I come back to it later and I rethink it. And so it's like resistance and then, okay, let's really think about it. So that might be construed as a weakness, not moving right away. But you know, we all have our moments. I haven't had to job interview and like, what are your greatest strengths and your greatest strengths? I do talk a lot, but I have...
Like, you are a storyteller. That's okay. You have a really good excuse.
Well, I've also tried to learn to balance that out with doing more listening and knowing when to stop and let the other side talk too.
What would be now? So let's say like a year from now, what would be the holy grail of success for you?
A year from now?
Let's say. You want a little bit more time? I'll give you a year and 2 months.
Thank you. How generous of you. First of all, I mean, on a national level, I hope that things are so much better than they are now for our people and our nation. But for me, success right now, I'm at a level where I just want to continue what I'm doing and get more speaking opportunities to spread the gospel of storytelling and more of my books in more people's hands and just to have a very full schedule working with people doing what I love. To me, I'm living the success. Like, I don't need a lot more than this. I mean, speaking at more conferences, more acknowledgement, not having to just having the work come to me. So more of that. I am very happy when I am doing what I do.
Donna, it sounds like you're truly the storyteller of your own life as well. And I think that's something to learn from. And I wish you to keep writing your story and that the next chapters will be as exciting as this. And that when you're scared, it becomes the excitement and you're always able to make those switches and your own way.
Amen to that, to all of us. I'll drink to that.
Cheers.
Cheers.
And Donna, I think it's a great attribute for anybody out there, because like these amazing people, which I totally agree, there's no such thing as an invaluable person. There's no such thing as a boring business. There's a reason that people opened up the business. It can't be boring for that certain person. So just making them excited, you know, about feeling excited about their, you know, personal perceptive of boring. A lot of talented individuals out there think that they're too boring to exist and they can be very brilliant. So I think it's a great attribution to have people that, yeah, it's, but you need some, you know, you got that person giving you that validation, right?
It's not just business, by the way. I teach a workshop called The X Factor, and it's finding your personal brand story. And I teach it a lot around International Women's Day, which is coming up, because unfortunately women are
brilliant.
Not as good as men in selling and self-promoting. And also people looking for jobs, people networking, and I'll work with them and then they'll create this X factor statement about themselves, like their true value, their talent, skills, and the value they bring to the company. And then I'll put it through the Donna GPT filter, listen to it, and then say, okay, here's your story. And then I pitch it and I see their face going like, and then they start to giggle. And it's like to see somebody oftentimes discovering their greatness for the first time, like truly putting a mirror to them is one of the greatest privileges of my life.
Beautiful. It's like you're adding color and empowering and making them see the better version of themselves.
And but it's what's there. And yeah. It's like we take it for granted. We do all these things. And we don't stop for a second to say, you're pretty effing amazing. And somebody needs to show you that about yourself. And it's okay to own that.
Which is so much what we're trying to do in this podcast.
And keep doing it because people need it.
We will. Thank you so much. I'm definitely going to stay in touch with you, Donna, as we have. And it's great speaking to you always.
Better. You too.
Thank you so much for your time. You're amazing. Thanks, Donna.
Thank you.
Bye.
That's all for today's episode. We hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please consider subscribing to our podcast so you never miss an episode. Also, if you have a moment, we would really appreciate it if you could rate and review our podcast on the platform you're listening to. This will help others find our show. And as always, if you know anyone who you think would enjoy our podcast, please share it with them. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back as usual on the first of the month.
Real. Live.
Superpowers.
Live.
Superpowers.